There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss. There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello, I'm Matt Kelly.
And I'm Matt D'Ancona.
And this is the Two Matts for the week ending Friday, the 1st of September. A pair of law-abiding citizens, it says here. Matt, what did we talk about this week?
Oh, we had a lot to talk about this week. We talked about the thrilling elevation of Mr. Grant Chapps. And we talked about Ulez vandalism, yeah, and Tory hypocrisy.
And we also had a game of two halves about Luis Rubiales, didn't we?
Yeah, we had one of our rare domestics about Rubiales, although it was a semi-domestic, I'd say. You know, it was a kind of quasi-domestic. No doors were slammed or ceramics broken.
I think I'm going to give you the home win on that match, I think.
Well, the VAR will have to check that one out.
What are we going to call this week's episode?
Grant Five Jobs Chaps.
I like that very much indeed.
Let's do that then.
Should we go with that? Five Jobs Chaps.
Five Jobs Chaps.
So this is the Two Matts, episode 11, Five Jobs Chaps.
Enjoy. Enjoy.
So, Matt, we're recording this on the morning of, or just actually lunchtime, of Thursday. And what's just happened this morning?
Well, it has been a morning of unmitigated excitement as Ben Wallace, who we knew was going to be replaced as Defence Secretary, he announced that he wanted to step down in the middle of July. And he's going to be replaced by Grant Chapps. Now, the immediately comic thing to observe about that is that Grant Chapps has done five, count them, cabinet posts in a year. Business Secretary, Home Secretary, a role he held for all of 6 days between Suella Braverman's two glorious 10 years of that office. Then Transport Secretary, Energy and Net Zero Secretary, and now Defence Secretary. It's interesting on a couple of levels. One is that I think we have to say Ben Wallace, against a fairly low bar, has been one of the more impressive members of this government. He called the retreat from Kabul very accurately. He read the intelligence, saw the Taliban was making big gains. This is in 2021. And unlike Dominic Raab, the then foreign secretary, who was incredibly dozy and didn't see what was happening, Wallace was saying to number 10, you got to prepare. You know, to the limited extent that we did get people out, that has a lot to do with Wallace. The other thing he did impressively was training Ukrainians before the invasion. Again, I don't think he necessarily knew that there was going to be a full-scale invasion by Putin, but he certainly knew there was trouble ahoy. And so, you know, his legacy at defence has been not too bad. And you know, the other thing to say about Ben Wallace is that he was consistently in polls of Tory members, their favourite cabinet minister, which leads to the question, why did he never stand for the leadership? Well, there's been unsubstantiated and often denied allegations about his private life, who knows? But in any case, he never did stand for the leadership, and he amazingly, and not to his credit, last October, when Boris Johnson, you recall, was trying to come back, flying back from the Dominican Republic, Ben Wallace said, I'm inclined to support Boris Johnson, which I don't think goes down to his credit on the ledger. But, you know, he's a former captain in the Scots Guards, he's a serious expert in defence policy. And he's being replaced by Grant Shapps, which kind of tells you all you need to know.
Who is an expert in selling encyclopedias.
Yes, and in pseudonyms, as we know, because he's had many names, Michael yes. Green and others, over the years. I mean, what Shapps is A, he's a Sunak loyalist. He briefly ran for the leadership himself last July, but then very quickly folded and backed Sunak and was very much a Sunak loyalist during the brief Truss premiership. And he's long been regarded as someone you can send out on the Sunday media round, on the Today programme. He's a punch bag. He doesn't fold under questioning. He doesn't necessarily say anything very interesting under questioning, but Sunak trusts him. I would question whether he has a huge amount to offer to the future of the nation's defence strategy. But what you can see is that Sunak is surrounding himself with loyalists, promoting loyalists. He's put Claire Coutinho into Shapps' old job, energy and net zero. Claire Coutinho was a special advisor to Sunak at the Treasury, amongst other things. So, you know, it's not hard to work out that he's rewarding loyalists. And that tells you a lot about the defensiveness that Sunak understandably feels at the moment.
The broader point I feel needs to be discussed is the lack of stability in government we've had since the Brexit referendum in the last 7 years. I mean, I was going through the list, and when you, it's interesting exercise when you go onto Wikipedia and you say, tell me all the foreign secretaries in the 20th century, you know, and the list for the last 7 years occupies about 6 inches, and then every previous decade it might be a couple of inches, you know, and in the last 7 years Great Britain has had 5 prime ministers, 7 home secretaries, 7 chancellors, and 7 foreign secretaries, just to cover the great offices of state. Now, compare that to the 10 years of Tony Blair. You had, obviously, 1 prime minister, 2 chancellors. No, you had 1 chancellor, didn't you? Gordon Brown.
One chancellor, all the way through.
Yeah, 1 chancellor. And that I think we can come back to, because I think that is the key relationship, isn't it, that needs to work. So you had that. You had 4 foreign secretaries in 10 years. You did have 6 home secretaries, but again, in 10 years. Thatcher, her 11 years, you had 3 home secretaries, 3 chancellors, and 3 foreign secretaries. So you can clearly see, over a period of 7 years, it's just been absolutely revolving doors, hasn't it?
Revolving doors mayhem.
How can anybody accomplish anything if the tenure of your job is 12 months, 18 months? You know, how can you bed in any kind of strategic response to anything in that period of time? And if Great Britain was a publicly listed company, the stock price would be in the penny shares basket, because nobody would look at the management of that company and say they're serious. Because with that turnover of staff, how can you do anything?
I mean, 2022 alone, you know, we had 3 prime ministers and 4 chancellors of the exchequer. How could one take a nation seriously? And indeed, we know from reading the foreign press that people don't take it seriously and regard it as a kind of volatility that Brits used to criticise in other nations like Italy and so on and mock. Well, you know, look at us now. It's an embarrassment. It's a national embarrassment. It's also a sign of structural incompetence and also weakness, because I think that he makes changes, Sunak makes changes where he has to, but he hasn't made changes where he ought to. So the screamingly obvious change you should have made today is to get rid of Suella Braverman, right? Twice Home Secretary, total disaster on both cases. From whatever angle, whether you take a more liberal approach to immigration or to a more sort of right-wing, you know, get the numbers down, strong borders approach, she's been a disaster. And the small boats Rwanda policy has been both a legal and a logistical and a humanitarian disaster. And we only have to think of the sort of symbolic ridiculousness of the Bibi Stockholm barge to realise that. She should be gone, but she isn't gone, and there's a reason for that, which is that Suella Braverman delivered Rishi Sunak the leadership of the Conservative Party last October when Boris Johnson crazily was flying back from the Dominican Republic in order to run only 7 weeks after he'd left office. And Braverman, clearly on a promise of being returned to the Home Office, displacing poor old chaps, said, no, 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 it should be Rishi Sunak. And, you know, Rishi Sunak fears her on, with good reason, on the back benches, because she's become a sort of figurehead of the, you know, the national conservative anti-immigration, anti-European Convention on Human Rights Toryism that I think is going to become more and more prevalent. So he hasn't done anything about her. Now, there is a steer, not a briefing, but a steer that there may be more to come in October. But I think that's hooey myself. There might be some changes, but Sunak has a bunch of dates coming up, right? He's got what may be his last party conference before the general election in October in Manchester. Then he's got, at some point in November, the autumn statement, which Jeremy Hunt will give. And then I think it's on, yeah, it's November the 7th, the King's first King's speech. And these dates are sort of being presented by number 10 as it's a cluster of, you know, a reset for the government. And there's a insinuation that there will be more shifts around the cabinet. Well, we'll see. This would have been the moment at the end of the summer after the disaster of Stop the Boats Week, which we all, you know, observed and were, you know, appalled by, to just call a halt on the Braverman issue. But he hasn't. Yeah. And so to me, that's the dog that didn't bark. It really is.
And it seems impossible or really, really far-fetched that the Conservative Party seems to be in such a state of chronic instability that if you're looking for a kind of meeting of minds, a pairing, that essential double act, and I'm talking largely about the Prime Minister and Chancellor relationship, that can effectively drive through strategic change in the country when, you know, Britain, in my lifetime, maybe once or twice before, it's felt like this was a pivotal moment of where a nation needed strategic leadership and change. It seems impossible that Rishi Sunak and Jeremy Hunt are going to be, you know, the Blair and Brown or the Cameron and Osborne or the Thatcher and Lawson of the 2020s. You know, it's not going to happen, is it? Which then leads you to what this country desperately needs is a change of government. Isn't that the only answer?
Yeah, it is the only answer. I mean, Jeremy Hunt's an interesting character because he is perhaps the last sort of representative of, he has his detractors and lots of people have strong views, understandably, about his tenure at Health, which was, I think, the longest ever. But, you know, he's indisputably a one-nation conservative, a technocratic conservative. But the party made very clear it did not want him as leader. You know, it just didn't want someone that old school as leader. So he was brought in as a kind of firefighter after the disaster of Kwasi Kwarteng as Chancellor by Liz Truss. It was Liz Truss that appointed him, not Sunak. Sunak keeps him. Hunt has kept an incredibly low profile since then. Barely seen. And I think that the reason for that is that he is presented with a pretty unappealing set of factors, you know, kind of givens, which is how the hell do we get inflation down? How the hell do I keep spending within reasonable limits? How the hell do I keep the party on side? How do I keep a increasingly, you know, nervous and edgy prime minister in his box? I think Jeremy Hunt's memoirs, when this is all over, will be really worth reading. But to your point, yeah. Matt, I mean, absolutely. You need to see that Blair Brown, early Thatcher Lawson kind of team up there all the time arguing. And you sort of get the feeling that Jeremy Hunt is buried in a you know, deep, deep vault somewhere in the Treasury, trying his best to make the figures add up. and trying somehow to get to the point where they can deliver what Sunak desperately wants, which is a tax cut promise before the next election. But it's all got very tawdry and shabby. You know, this is not a top team. That it feels rudderless, doesn't it? It feels as if the ship of state is just veering from one side to another.
I mean, I've been listening to the audio book of the Anthony Seldon Cameron, which you feature in regularly. And I didn't appreciate just how close you were to the Cameron lobby, but according to this anyway. So you're spoken of several times in very high estimation about your insight, which I'm sure the listeners of this great podcast, I say great, immodestly, this podcast will be enjoying.
Mighty, I think is a better word.
This mighty podcast. Even Cameron Osborne, who, I mean, I found pretty much everything they did reprehensible. We can argue the toss about that in a future date. But what comes through clearly is that there's a dynamic between the two and an understanding and a sense of partnership and a willingness to maneuver and compromise and bend with the wind. And you don't see that now. What you see is a very fractious set of individuals all in a state of slight panic and bemusement and discombobulation. And the country, I feel, is now reflecting that. I don't think anybody understands what Britain stands for anymore. I don't think anybody understands what our strategy is for improving the things that we all depend on day to day, like infrastructure, like the NHS, like education, like employment, like immigration. Nobody's got a bloody clue about that. So I feel we are mightily adrift as a nation. And I don't quite, you know, whoever comes in afterwards has both got the biggest opportunity, but also the biggest challenge to re-galvanize Britain and give it a sense of purpose, I think.
Well, it's interesting you mention Cameron Osborne, because you're right. I mean, park for a moment what they did, just talk about their methods. One of the interesting things about Cameron and Osborne was that, let's say that Cameron was going to see Obama in Washington, he'd take Osborne with him. You know, they were a duumvirate. There wasn't a cigarette paper between them. I mean, actually, funnily enough, given Rachel Reeves, in my view, foolishly ruling out wealth taxes this week, the Shadow Chancellor. One of the few differences between Cameron and Osborne was over the wealth tax, because Osborne wanted to push ahead with it, take advantage of, you know, the fact that they were in coalition with the Lib Dems and get on with it on the grounds that wealth was undertaxed and income was overtaxed. And Cameron just said, no way, you know, our donors will never put up with it. But that was a very rare example of disagreement, and it was private. So yeah, you're right. And what's happened is that sort of strength of presentation to the world, not just to the country, but to the world, has completely evaporated. You know, we are, unfortunately, and I hope it's an impermanent position, but we are a joke nation at the moment. Other than our contributions to the Ukraine effort, we are regarded as a joke nation. And, you know, there are very, very clear reasons for that. Incidentally, I mean, to the list of things that Brexit is responsible for, Ben Wallace wanted to very badly be NATO General Secretary and had all the credentials. But Emmanuel Macron said, no, we need someone from inside the EU, which is not actually an unreasonable objection because of the structure Absolutely. Of NATO, yeah. You know, and Jens Stoltenberg is, who's currently General Secretary and has been given another year, former Norwegian Prime Minister outside the EU. So Macron was, no, the next General Secretary has to be someone from inside the EU. So yet again,
fascinating.
You know, we find another one of those Brexit dividends, you know, it's extraordinary.
By the way, apropos nothing except for a very special offer for listeners of this podcast, I've been reading the most excellent Rory Stewart book in proof
form,
Politics on the Edge. Actually, I'll send it to you so you can get it.
I can't wait to see it.
If anybody was in any doubt about Cameron's logic about calling for a referendum, he he is absolutely nailed on to the well-worn theory, but still not proven, is that Cameron was absolutely convinced that in 2015 there would be another coalition government and the Lib Dems in coalition would get him off the hook from this promise. So that Tory victory in 2015 was cataclysmic in at least that one big regard.
Absolutely. I mean, there's no doubt that he thought it would, the promise in 2013 of the referendum would get UKIP off his back. It didn't, but he thought it would. And then he wins. And Osborne and others say, don't do it, don't do it. But by that stage, having won, and having, in his view, you know, won the Scottish referendum and various other things, his view was, I'm a winner. You know, that was what he said to people, I'm a winner, which is a terrible delusion for a prime minister to become captive to, because no one is axiomatically a winner. You know, you don't always win.
No,
if you hold a referendum, especially on something like this, you don't just win because it's you, David Cameron, leading it. So it was a disaster. Yeah. And, you know, sadly for him, it's what he'll be remembered for.
Well, I'm sure he's had plenty of time to reflect on that in his shepherd's hut and the various super yachts he no doubt spends his holidays on and stuff and so on and so forth. Bit of bitterness thrown in there for free. Let's talk a little bit about ULEZ. And
yes,
only because we've talked about it before in the podcast, but it has obviously it's been the week of weeks for ULEZ protests. And I've been massively struck, as I know you have, at the difference in attitude from some of the right-wing press, the Mail particularly, in their attitude towards the protesters, comparing their attitude towards, say, Extinction Rebellion or Just Stop Oil. They're fully on board with these protesters, aren't they?
Oh, these are good protesters. You know, it's hilarious. You've got Ian Duncan Smith, Mr. Law and Order, saying he completely understands the vandalism of ULEZ cameras by his constituents because ULEZ is a very bad thing. You know, but he's always the first to, I mean, I don't know if he said anything about the Notting Hill Carnival or Just Stop Oil specifically, but, you know, he's the absolute archetypal Tory who is on TV or LBC or something like that saying, you know, this is an absolute outrage, you know, we're the party of law and order. But for some reason, destroying ULEZ cameras and facilities is the action of a true liberty-loving Briton. And, of course, what you're seeing here is yet another front in the culture war opening up, which is, especially post-COVID, the Tories think there's a sort of appetite out there for libertarian, pro-motorist, anti-net-zero action voters, and they're going to absolutely milk it for all it's worth. I mean, obviously, it's worth pointing out that ULEZ is about air pollution rather than climate change, but, you know, it's all part of the same portmanteau of policies and measures. And it's an alarming step because actually I think ULEZ is a really good policy, and I think that Sadiq Khan, the mayor, is entirely sincere in this, and he has resisted pressure from Keir Starmer, who was very much unsettled by the Labour's defeat or failure to capture the Uxbridge constituency in the Uxbridge by-election in July, and very publicly said, you know, we need to rethink ULEZ. And to his credit, I think Sadiq Khan stood his ground and said, no, I am going to extend ULEZ to the outer boroughs. And the reasons he cited are good ones, you know, health, but also it's a social justice issue because every single study that's been done around the world, but also in this country specifically, about air pollution shows that it is always the poorest to get hit worst in terms of health because they live in areas where there's population density, highest traffic and so on. So Khan is saying, look, you know, half of London households don't have a car and it's the poor that suffer most. This is only applying to cars that were registered before 2005. You know, you can handle this. And I think the fact that he's showing some stamina and some durability is very much to his credit.
And I've got those Ian Duncan Smith quotes. He's talking about people vandalising government property or mayoral property. I'm happy for them to do it. They've been lied to, he said. Now, flashback to June, where he was talking about Just Stop Oil protesters.
Oh, right.
And he
right.
was encouraging magistrates. Yeah. So the one thing that gets them thinking is if you start fining them £1,000 every time they do this kind of thing, you know, so he's absolutely jackbooting down on Just Stop Oil. But if you want to tear down an ULEZ camera, then on you go, mate. And in June in The Sun, he wrote, Labour is the party of protest and disorder. Astonishingly, the Labour Party has thrown its lot in with the protesters. And here he is saying to the ULEZ protesters, I'm your man, you know. So he wins the Doublethink Award of 2023. But I agree with you about ULEZ. I think it's a wholly good thing. And, you know, obviously change is difficult for people and there will be some people. And, of course, there are anomalous cases where, like for late night shift workers, for instance, who might get charged twice if they're crossing a border over midnight and stuff. But the reality is if this is saving lives and that, you know, there's a disproportionate amount of asthmatic deaths in London, which there is, then it can only, the arguments kind of fall away. The thing I rail against, and maybe we should come back to this, is the low traffic neighbourhoods, the LTNs, which are springing up all over the place. And we live in one. And I don't get the logic apart from, because wherever there's a low traffic neighbourhood, it means there's a high traffic neighbourhood somewhere. And they're moving traffic into other streets. And there are streets in Islington where I live. If podcast listeners haven't guessed I lived in Islington, then they know now.
They might have guessed.
They are chock full of cars. And many of them have primary schools on them and stuff like this. And so I think that's a really suspect rule, to be honest. But I am all for the conversion to electric cars and no polluting cars. I think it's just an inevitable change, and the sooner we do it, the better.
I think, you know, what you've just expressed, Matt, is a very interesting point, which is the move to a greener world, the move to a world where the air is decent and, you know, we handle what we do with cars in a sensible way. It's quite a subtle business and it requires good faith. But the thing has become so polarized. So either you're totally on the side of every single, you know, measure, or you're totally against it. And actually, this is no way to proceed with an environmental strategy that we need at pace. So actually, I hate to agree with Sunak, but he may be right. There may be a case for a review of LTNs. Okay, but the problem is that he said that in the context of immediately after Uxbridge, in a sort of triumphalist mode of, you know, we're going to roll back on net zero, we're going to be pro-motorists and all that. So the whole thing gets lost in a culture war argument between green on the one hand and libertarian on the other, which is a disaster for policy formation. I only hope that if Starmer wins the election, he's not drawn into an ultra-cautious approach where he feels constantly that he has to appease people who will be no doubt becoming more and more vocal, more and more you know, on the streets and aggressive in their opposition to anything that is pro-net zero, pro-greenery. This is too important to be, you know, kind of consigned to the world of politics, if you like, or certainly populist politics.
Should we take a break and come back and talk about...
Let's take a break.
...a controversy on other shores? See you in a moment, listeners.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices
down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
That's the sound of another sale on Shopify, in store. Shopify POS is everything you need to sell in person. From payments to inventory, Shopify unites your sales into one commerce platform. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/retail23. shopify.com/retail23.
So Matt, after the great triumph of Spanish women in the World Cup, in the Women's World Cup, England sadly gallant losers. But of course, it's been totally dominated, the story, by the story of Luis Rubiales and the kissing of Jenny Hermosa on World TV, and the fallout ever since. And I have very mixed feelings about this. Why don't you pitch in with where you stand?
All right. Well, let me make the I suppose more orthodox case for the prosecution, which is, okay, Luis Rubiales, president of the RFEF, the Spanish Football Federation. On the night of the victory, great, great moment for Spain, not just for Spanish women's sport, women's football, but, for Spain. He grabs Jenny Hermosa and he's above her on a platform and he kisses her full on the lips. Now, there's a pattern of behaviour on the night, let alone in his past, because he also on the night throws another player, Athena de Castillo, over his shoulder, and he also grabs his crotch in the VIP area in a very Spanish macho way to indicate, I think he's signalling to Jorge Vila, the Spanish women's coach, that, the guy has balls. So it's not a great night for Rubiales. Now, before we go into the sort of tangled chronology of what then happened, I think the problem here is this, which is the whole point of Me Too is that for it to work, we have to ditch all those old school defences, which is, it was a bit of fun, it was heat of the moment, where's your sense of humour, where's your sense of proportion? This was an act of very clear masculine domination of a woman. And I think that the fact that it's caused such a strong reaction is actually not surprising. And I am startled, perhaps I shouldn't be, that Rubiales is still in post. Over to you.
Yeah.
For the more
well,
nuanced
point
of view.
Well, I mean, that's such a compelling, that if I was facing you in court as a KC, I'd be trembling at this stage, because I think you've nailed it.
But you're not.
It. And I do think I'm not really, no. I think there is no doubt that the best course of action for him right now is he has to resign. It's just become utterly absurd. And maybe by the time this podcast gets out, he will have resigned, because he is completely isolated. And there is certainly enough of a huge question around his behaviour that he has not represented the Royal Spanish Football Federation in the manner that he should have done. And he has brought shame onto the sport at its greatest moment. The thing that I'm a bit uncomfortable about is, and we touched on it with the Hugh Edwards story before Hugh Edwards' name came out, is the...
We had a domestic about that.
Absolute tidal wave of opinion that makes it any defence impossible. And I do think that everybody is entitled to make a case for themselves. And I think whether, all he's come out and he said it was consensual, that she said it was okay, and there's clearly some confusion over in his head over whether or not he was doing something wrong. Because I would ask the question, if you're going to sexually assault somebody, do you do it with 2 billion people watching on television? Probably not. But there clearly is a pattern of absolute arrogance with this guy, which was clearly exemplified in his that infamous speech now, where he said, I will not resign. What I would notice is look at the audience when he makes that speech. They're all clapping. You know, you've got your women sitting on their hands. But if you look at 90% of the men, they're all clapping. And the point I'd make is, and where I'm uncomfortable, is that I always hate it when somebody is made an example of and is crucified to such a complete level to make an example for others to follow. And I find that uncomfortable because none of us are perfect and we've all made mistakes. And when you become the focus of that crucifixion because you are just the wrong person at the wrong place at the wrong time, as I think this guy is, and I'm not making any plea for mitigation for what he did. What he did was obviously wrong, and he deserves to lose his job for sure. But I do hate it. It makes me feel a little bit uncomfortable when an individual is crucified like this instantly and can't make a defence for himself effectively.
Well, hold on a second. Not only does he get to make a defence for himself at great and slightly deranged length, but the RFEF threatened to sue Jenny Hermosa for daring to say that it wasn't consensual. So the crucifixion, to use your phrase, there are two crosses up there, right? It's not just, as it were, Rubiales being, you know, surrounded by a woke mob, for want of a better phrase, and told, you know, away with you. You've actually got the woman in question being subjected to legal threats from the Federation for not falling into line. And the real problem with this, I think, was that they and Rubiales himself jumped the gun by putting words in her mouth, because she didn't say, "I consented to it." Quite the contrary, but they press released and insisted that she had. She said, "I didn't. I didn't consent to it. I felt very uncomfortable." And they said, "Right, you are going to face legal action." So there's crucifixion on both sides. And I think there's something ugly in that. And the other thing I'd say, and as you know, I'm trying to earn my spurs as a football expert, right? Under your tutelage. I mean, I think it is fair to say, is it not, that he has lost the dressing room, right? Since
he
just
has
about
lost
every
the dressing room,
just about every Spanish woman player has said they won't play under the current leadership. And you know, it's Vila, Jorge Vila, the manager, has having initially stood by Rubiales, has courageously decided that he didn't support him all along.
Yeah.
So it's a mess, and you're right. It only leads to one thing, but the tragedy for the Spanish women's side, along with the initial act of harassment, abuse, whatever you want to call it, is that it's completely taken the shine off what was a spectacular, I mean, shame for us because we were supporting the Lionesses, but it was a really impressive victory.
But if let me make one final point, which, and again, just to underscore that I'm not defending what he did. I'm just defending his right to have a slightly calmer atmosphere and some process around what will inevitably end up as his dismissal. That is probably his fault, the way he's gone about it. But my point is that he is very much part of a broader problem in Spanish society, which isn't just about sexism, but racism as well. I've worked in Spain for several years, and there are deep-rooted problems in their society that we wouldn't recognize. I don't know if you remember, was it the 2008, going off to Beijing, and they were all doing slanty eye jokes on in the official photograph of this, you know, that didn't shock me. I wasn't surprised at that because that's what Spain can be like. So in a sense, I think two things. One is we've all said, what a shame that this story has overtaken the spin. Well, if this story becomes part of a sea change in Spanish society, then what better legacy could that World Cup football win have? One thing. But two, I do think focusing on Rubiales as an individual and focusing on that kiss as a specific moment in time is a mistake. I think they've got to address much broader issues. And if anybody thinks that crucifying Rubiales is going to instigate a Me Too movement in Spain, I think they're being very optimistic. I think it runs a lot deeper than it does in other countries, especially in Europe. Anyway, that's my top and
switch. Yeah, it has to be a symbol rather than just a way of pushing the whole issue aside. But I think it will be. I mean, on the issue of crucifixion, I'd say that Rubiales put at least three of the nails in himself, right? So it's auto crucifixion. Actually, you can only put in two, can't you? Just to be on the. To be strictly accurate about auto crucifixion, yeah. But the other thing that just strikes me, just as a sort of thought experiment, is imagine that Gareth Southgate is promoted to chief executive of the FA, and the women's team wins, the Euros, for the sake of argument. You just cannot imagine Gareth Southgate doing the same to Lauren James, Alex Greenwood. And I think, if we're going to be new Europeans, right, we can't say, Spaniards are all bullfighters and machismo. And it's like, there has to be a sort of commonality of decency. That's all I think, really, which is that I'm not impressed by the arguments that, Rubiales is he's a bullfighter, and he's a macho man. Bollocks, he's a sexist pig. And he's going to get what's coming to him, I think.
Okay, well, that's on that bombshell. I think, by the way, we are both agreed that he's a sexist pig. There's no two ways about that. It's just how you go about addressing it is my question. That's all. Okay, so Matt, what didn't we have time to talk about?
Well, actually, you brought up something which really made me go away and dig and think, which was you talk about it.
Well, the RSPB you're talking about.
Yeah.
The RSPB, which is obviously the charity that looks after the interests of birds primarily, and also more broadly nature and the countryside, they have a big interest in that, obviously, with the environment being so essential to bird life. They sent out a tweet, a really stinging tweet. It was so stinging it could have come from the Twitter channel of the New European. It was like calling Sunak and Theresa Coffey liars and saying they've betrayed the environment, and it was really full on.
I thought it was great.
I thought it was terrific.
It's wonderful, wasn't it?
I just thought, if you feel strongly about something, then bloody well say it, but this morning on the Today programme, the chief executive of the RSPB was on saying that it was inappropriate to target individuals and they should instead target the policy, and that she was concerned about the state of public discourse. And I too am concerned about the state of public discourse, in that people are not calling out the villains as much as they should be. And I thought, the RSPB should think again and be more on the front foot about saying, no, mate, it's you, Rishi Sunak, it's you, Theresa Coffey, who are leading this damage, and Michael Gove as well.
Well, how do lies happen? Liars tell them. That's how they happen. Liars in high public office. That's and right. I think that one of the things is that I get that for, obscure ancestral reasons, it's impossible for MPs to call each other liars in the House of Commons, right? But that shouldn't curtail the rest of us. And, we live in an era when, to say the least, politicians play fast and loose with the truth. And I don't think there should be a kind of a veto on use of the word liars. Quite the contrary. I think we should use it more often.
What else did we miss this week?
Well, it was interesting to read that Nadeem Zahawi, very briefly Chancellor of the Exchequer, who had to leave government rather hastily because of difficulties over tax, now appears to be advising the Barclay family over the sale of the Telegraph Group. They want to buy it back they say they've secured the necessary line of credit. This would be an astonishing turn of fortune. Lloyds, who are running the sale, say that they're not interested, so it may not go anywhere. But of course, the bigger question is, you know, what the hell is Zahawi doing in the middle of all this? And apparently, if it was successful, he would become chair of the Telegraph Group, which is a very peculiar arrangement. So again, it's the other revolving door, isn't it? Where there's this unhealthily close relationship between newspapers and politicians, I think. I hope that relationship is severed, actually. I really do. We've had an era where they've been very close, but I hope it ends.
I was reading some of the comments on Mark Thompson, who happens to be an investor in the New European, but was also obviously the former director general of the BBC, chief executive of the New York Times, and is now the new boss at CNN, which desperately needs turning around. And Mark was talking
excellent
about
choice.
Part of
really
the problem
good
of media. Excellent. Top guy. Mark was talking about the problem of everybody thinking politicians are bent and corrupt, but the reality is that they also think the media are part of that same cabal,
yes,
and that it's all part of a big elite, and you have to cut that cord. I hope very much that the New European is playing a small part in cutting that cord, because there's no way anyone could point at us and say we're part of the establishment, because we slag the establishment off every single week.
And wouldn't it be great to see CNN restored to its former glory in an election year? I mean, what an opportunity they've got, you know, under Mark's leadership. Yeah. It's going to be, fingers crossed, because, and all the best to him, you know. I think it's going to be really interesting to see how he does.
Good luck, Mark Thompson. Okay, folks, I hope you've enjoyed
luck,
the podcast. Thank you again for listening. And please tell all your friends about it if you enjoy it. If you don't like it, tell nobody. Remember, we have a special deal for listeners of the Two Mats, and it's a subscription to the New European. And when you subscribe, from just £1 a week, you will get a free signed copy of Rory Stewart's new book, Politics on the Edge. And I've got to tell you, I have read it. I've almost finished it. It is beautifully written, as you would expect with Rory Stewart, but it's a fabulous insight into a very rocky period of time in politics. And to get that offer for just £1 a week, or £2 a week if you like to get the newspaper delivered to your door every week, you just go to theneweuropean.co.uk/2mats. That's the number 2, MATTS. theneweuropean.co.uk/2mats. And there's a link in the show notes. Thank you, as always, to The Third Mat, our producer, Matt Hill at Rethink Audio. And until next week,
it's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from him.
Goodbye.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
That's the sound of another sale on Shopify in store. Shopify POS is everything you need to sell in person. From payments to inventory, Shopify unites your sales into one commerce platform. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/retail23. Shopify.com/retail23.